A dedication appears. The cast and crew of Star Trek wish to dedicate this film to the men and women of the spaceship Challenger, whose courageous spirit shall live to the 23rd century and beyond. Now, a triangular mountain peak draped with snow. Five-pointed stars form a ring around it. A logo appears, Paramount, a Gulf and Western company. Now, titles appear in sleek, futuristic lettering. Paramount Pictures presents a Harve Bennett production. In a deep space sky sprinkled with dim stars, flashes converge in a brilliant explosion of light, which fades into a glimmering title, Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home. Starring William Shatner, Leonard Nimoy, and DeForest Kelly. Co-starring James Doohan, George Takei, Walter Koenig, and Nichelle Nichols. Also starring Mark Leonard as Sarek, Jane Wyatt as Amanda, Majel Barrett as Commander Chapel, and Robert Ellenstein as the Council President. With John Shook as the Klingon Ambassador, Brock Peters as Admiral Cartwright, Robin Curtis as Lieutenant Savick, and Catherine Hicks as Jillian. Executive Consultant Gene Roddenberry. Music by Leonard Rosenman. Edited by Peter E. Berger. Production Designer Jack T. Collins. Director of Photography Don Peterman, ASC. Executive Producer Ralph Winter. Based on Star Trek, created by Gene Roddenberry. Story by Leonard Nimoy and Harve Bennett. Screenplay by Steve Meerson, Peter Kreitz, Harve Bennett, and Nicholas Meyer. Produced by Harve Bennett. Directed by Leonard Nimoy. Now, a nebula appears in the starry deep space, a transparent pink haze with a luminous orange center. The cloud grows bluish at its wispy outer edges, then a shape emerges from its center. In a starship, a scanning computer displays the shape, a perfect cylinder with a small suspended globe.
What do you make of it?
A science officer shakes his head.
It appears to be a probe, Captain. From an intelligence unknown to us.
Continue transmitting universal peace and hello in all known languages. Get me Starfleet Command.
Ready, Captain.
Starfleet Command, this is USS Saratoga patrolling Sector 5, neutral zone. We're tracking a probe of unknown origin on apparent trajectory to the Terran solar system. Attempts to communicate with the probe have been negative on all known frequencies.
Continue tracking, Saratoga. We will analyze transmissions and advise.
Roger, Starfleet. Saratoga out.
The Saratoga's sensor screen focuses on the globe suspended from the cylinder's front end. Now, San Francisco Bay, outside the Federation of Planets building. Inside, footage with Klingon captioning appears on a large screen. Klingons have swarthy skin and bony ridges on their foreheads.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
On screen, an explosion rips apart the Starship Enterprise's front saucer. Klingons on the Enterprise's bridge disappear as the ship plummets. Below its blown-in-half saucer, two arms angle down to a cylindrical hull. Federation Council members watch in a dim chamber as Admiral Kirk appears on screen.
I fully understand the events in which I
report. Hold the image.
It is necessary
hold!
To review.
A Klingon ambassador.
Behold the quintessential devil in these matters, James T. Kirk, renegade and terrorist. Not only is he responsible for the murder of a Klingon crew, the theft of the Klingon vessel, see now the real plot and intentions. Even as this Federation was negotiating a peace treaty with us, Kirk was secretly developing the Genesis torpedo, conceived by Kirk's son and test detonated by the Admiral himself. And the result of this awesome energy was euphemistically called the Genesis Planet, a secret base from which to launch the annihilation of the Klingon people. We demand the extradition of Kirk. We demand justice.
Klingon justice is a unique point of view, Mr. President.
Sorry.
Council members turn their gaze to a silver-haired, shark-eared Vulcan in a dark robe.
Genesis was perfectly named. The creation of life, not death. The Klingons shed the first blood while attempting to possess its secrets.
Vulcans are well known as the intellectual puppets of this Federation.
Your vessel did destroy USS Grissom. Your men did kill Kirk's son. Do you deny these events?
We deny nothing. We have the right to preserve our race.
You have the right to commit murder?
Silence! Silence!
The white-bearded president.
No further outbursts from the floor.
Mr. President, I've come to speak on behalf of the accused.
Personal bias! His son was saved by Kirk.
Mr. Ambassador, with all respect, the Council's deliberations are over.
Then Kirk goes unpunished?
Admiral Kirk has been charged with 9 violations of Starfleet regulations.
Starfleet regulations? That's outrageous! Remember this well. There shall be no peace as long as Kirk lives.
Glowering, the long-haired Klingon ambassador stalks out of the dark council hall. Now, a landscape of orange rock valleys and stark mountains topped with cone-shaped buildings.
Captain's log, stardate 8390. We're in the third month of our Vulcan exile, and it was Dr. McCoy with a fine sense of historical irony who decided on a name for our captured Klingon vessel.
The HMS Bounty.
And like those mutineers of 500 years ago, we too have a hard choice to make.
Dr. McCoy?
Aye, sir.
Mr. Scott?
Aye, sir.
Uhura?
Aye, sir.
Chekov?
Aye, sir.
Sulu?
Aye, sir.
Let the record show that the commander and the crew of the late Starship Enterprise have voted unanimously to return to Earth to face the consequences of their actions in the rescue of their comrade, Captain Spock. Thank you all. Repair stations, please. Mr. Scott.
Aye, sir.
How soon can we be underway?
Oh, give me one more day, sir. Damage control is easy. Reading Klingon, that's hard.
Kirk and Dr. McCoy exchange a smile.
You'd think they could at least send a ship. It's bad enough to be court-martialed and spend the rest of our lives mining borite, but to have to go home in this Klingon flea trap.
We can learn a thing or two from this flea trap. It's got a cloaking device that costs us a lot.
I just wish we could cloak the stench.
McCoy heads toward the Klingon ship. Kirk peers up at a cliff. A robed figure stands at its steep edge, then turns and walks out of sight. Kirk frowns with concern. Later, wearing a white robe, the sharp-eared Spock approaches 3 computers in the center of a room. Each screen is a sheet of smoky glass.
Computer, resume testing.
Who said logic is the cement of our civilization with which we ascend from EKS using reason as our guide?
T. Planahath, matron of Vulcan philosophy.
Correct. What is the molecular formula of humanium sulfide crystals?
He punches in a formula.
White queen to section 5, grid 6, queen takes knight, rook takes queen, white pawn to section 5, grid 7, pawn takes rook. Checkmate. What significant correct contribution to bioengineering was made in Lucarian outposts on Clint?
The universal atmospheric element compensator.
Evaluate and conclude. A starship sensor is indicated as being pursued so closely that it occupies the same space as its pursuer.
Correct.
Identify object and its cultural significance.
Klingon mummification glyph.
What were the principal historical events on the planet Earth in the year 1987?
Correct.
What was Kira Kim Thaw's first law of metaphysics?
Nothing unreal exists.
Correct.
Adjust the sine wave of this magnetic envelope so that anti-neutrons can pass through it, but anti-gravitons cannot.
Correct.
What is the electronic configuration of gadolinium?
Correct.
How do you feel?
Spock's razor-thin eyebrows frown. His eyes shift.
How do you feel? How do you feel?
I do not understand the question.
What is it, Spock?
A slender woman in the doorway.
I do not understand the question, Mother.
Well, you're half human. The computer knows that.
The question is irrelevant.
Spock, the retraining of your mind has been in the Vulcan way, so you may not understand feelings. But as my son, you have them. They will surface.
As you wish, since you deem them of value. But I cannot wait here to find them.
Why? Where must you go?
I must go to Earth to offer testimony.
You do this for friendship?
I do it because I was there.
Spock, does the good of the many outweigh the good of the one?
I would accept that as an axiom.
Well, then you stand here alive because of a mistake made by your flawed, feeling human friends. They have sacrificed their futures because they believed that the good of the one, you, was more important to them.
Humans make illogical decisions.
They do indeed.
He lifts his right eyebrow at her. Now, the Saratoga's sensor screen shows the approach of the massive black cylindrical probe.
Here he comes now.
Its small glowing blue globe is segmented like cobblestones. It hangs by a shaft of light. Lights blink off on the Saratoga's bridge.
What's causing that?
Their call is being carried on an amplification wave of enormous power.
Can we isolate the wave?
Negative. It's impacting on all our systems.
Yellow alert. Shields up. Hell, reduce closing speed.
Thruster controls have been neutralized.
Emergency thrusters.
No response, Captain.
A control panel sparks.
Emergency lights.
Smoke fills the room.
Damage report.
All systems have failed. We're functioning on reserve power only.
The ship tilts to one side as the probe, hundreds of times larger, passes overhead.
Starfleet Command, this is Saratoga. Can you hear me? Come in, please. Come in, please.
Her face lit by red emergency light, the captain's brow furrows hopelessly. Keeling over, the saucer-shaped Saratoga drifts toward us with its lights off, now at Federation headquarters.
Thank you, sir.
The president approaches a tall black admiral.
Status report, Admiral.
Not good, Mr. President. The probe is headed directly toward us. Its signal is damaging everything in its path. Klingons have lost two vessels. Two starships and three smaller vessels have been neutralized.
Neutralized? How?
We don't know. Get me the Yorktown.
They face a large wall monitor. A captain's face appears.
Emergency channel 0130. Code red. It has been 3 hours since our contact with the alien probe. All attempts at regaining power have failed.
It's using forms
all
of energy our best scientists do not understand.
Have been given can you protect us?
We're launching everything we have.
Life support reserves. Our chief engineer is trying to deploy a makeshift solar sail. We have high hopes that this will, if successful, generate power to keep us alive.
Now the huge probe passes us. Its smooth metallic underside gleams in contrast to its rough, corrugated front face. On the planet Vulcan, the Klingon ship sits on a launch pad. Inside, two doors part automatically. Kirk steps into the command room.
Systems report. Communications.
Communication systems all ready, sir. Communications officer as ready as she'll ever be.
Guidance is functional. Onboard computer will interface with Federation memory bank.
Weapon systems.
Operational, Admiral. Cloaking device now available on all flight modes.
I'm impressed. That's a lot of work for a short voyage.
We are in an enemy vessel, sir. Do not wish to be shot down on the way to our own funeral.
Good thinking. Engine room. Report, Mr. Scott.
We're ready, sir. I've converted the dilithium sequencer into something a little less primitive. And, Admiral, I have replaced the Klingon food packs. They were giving me a sour stomach.
Oh, is that what it was? Prepare for departure. Everybody not going to Earth had better get off. Savick.
A young Vulcan officer.
This is goodbye.
Yes, Admiral.
Thank you.
Sir, I have not had the opportunity to tell you about your son. David died most bravely. He saved Spock. He saved us all. I thought you should know.
Kirk nods solemnly. Spock enters. Savick turns to leave and faces him.
Good day, Captain Spock. May your journey be free of incident.
Live long and prosper, Lieutenant.
Savick steps out.
Permission to come aboard.
Permission granted.
Thank you, Admiral.
Jim. Spock. Jim. Don't you remember?
It would not be proper to refer to you as Jim while you're in command, Admiral. Also, I must apologize for my attire. I seem to have misplaced my uniform.
Kirk smiles a little.
Station.
Spock nods and takes his post. The lean, weathered McCoy glances dubiously after him.
Are you sure this is such a bright idea?
What do you mean?
I mean him. Back at his post like nothing happened. I don't know if you've got the whole picture or not, but he's not exactly working on all thrusters.
It'll come back to him.
Are you sure?
Kirk stares hard at McCoy, then steps down to the captain's chair with a tight-lipped sigh.
That's what I thought.
Mr. Sulu, take us home.
Thrust is functional?
The Klingon ship, like a grim metal bird with its wings angled upward, rises from the launch pad in a cloud of steam.
One quarter impulse power.
Sulu steers from a console in front of Kirk. Spock's mother and Savick watch from a craggy hilltop. The ship's pod-like head, long neck, and squat body pass over them. It soars across the deep valley toward a brilliant orange sun. Now, the massive probe glides toward a brightly lit, mushroom-shaped space station, casting a dark shadow over the entire structure.
Space dock, this is Starlink. Launch all vessels.
Two officers at a control panel.
Sir, space dock doors are inoperative. All emergency systems are non-functional.
Engage reserve power.
Aye, sir.
Starfleet Command, this is Space Dock, an emergency channel. We have lost all internal power.
As the control chamber goes black, the space dock's pinpoints of light dim, then vanish. The engines of two oncoming ships go dead. The probe continues on its path, leaving the ghostly space dock floating with all of its lights extinguished. The top half of the spinning, segmented globe glows from the blinding beam of light attaching it to the probe. It swiftly approaches the Earth's atmosphere. The blue globe rotates left, then right. On Earth, a bolt of energy cuts through an ocean in a bright laser-like line. A sheer wall of water shoots up from it. Dense clouds billow and churn in a dark spreading layer above the wall. The probe hovers high overhead. Now the Klingon bird of prey zooms through space.
Estimating planet Earth, 1.6 hours present speed.
Continue on course. Mr. Chekov, any sign of Federation escort?
No, sir. And no Federation vessels on assigned patrol stations.
Kirk spins his chair.
That's odd. Uhura, what's on the comm channels?
Very active, sir. Multiphasic transmissions overlapping. It's almost a gibberish. Let me see if I can sort it out.
McCoy sits at Spock's side.
Hi. Busy?
Uhura is busy. I am monitoring.
Well, I just want to say, it sure is nice to have your Katra back in your head, not mine. What I mean is, I may have carried your soul, but I sure couldn't fill your shoes.
My shoes?
McCoy's smile fades.
Forget it. Perhaps we could cover a little philosophical ground. Life, death, life, things of that nature.
I did not have time on Vulcan to review the philosophical disciplines.
Come on, Spock, it's me, McCoy. You really have gone where no man's gone before. Can't you tell me what it felt like?
It would be impossible to discuss the subject without a common frame of reference.
You're joking.
A joke is a story with a humorous climax.
You mean I have to die to discuss your insights on death?
Forgive me, Doctor. I'm receiving a number of distress calls.
I don't doubt it.
McCoy eyes him incredulously. Pressing a listening device to his ear, Spock lifts his eyebrows. On Earth, wind blasts across the ocean toward the wall of water, sucked upward into a thick gray canopy of mist. Seen from orbit, clouds swirl and cloak the Earth's atmosphere. Light flashes randomly underneath the dark layer. A branch of lightning flashes on screen at Federation headquarters. The president frowns.
General Alaska, clouds increased 95%.
Admiral Cartwright stands next to him.
Tokyo, total cloud coverage. All power from reserve banks. Leningrad has lost all electrical power. Cloud coverage 100%. Temperatures decreasing rapidly.
What is the estimate cloud cover of the planet at this time?
78.6%.
Notify all stations. Starfleet emergency, red alert. Switch power immediately to planetary reserves.
Switch it now, Ed.
Lights in the command center flash on and off.
Mr. President, even with planetary reserves, we cannot survive without the sun.
I'm well aware of that, Admiral.
The president nods grimly and approaches Spock's father, Sarek.
Ambassador Sarek, I'm afraid you're trapped here with us. There seems to be no way we can answer this probe.
It's difficult to answer when one does not understand the question. Mr. President, perhaps you should transmit a planetary distress signal. But we still have time.
Rain streams down the center's fogged windows. Now, inside the Bird of Prey, Uhura holds a listening device to her ear.
Admiral.
What is it?
Overlapping distress calls, and now a message coming in from the Federation.
On screen.
The president's face appears through a field of static on a wall monitor.
This is the President of the United Federation of Planets. Do not approach Earth. The transmissions of an orbiting probe are causing critical damage to this planet. It has almost totally ionized our atmosphere. All power sources have failed. All Earth-orbiting starships are powerless. The probe is vaporizing our oceans. We cannot survive unless a way can be found to respond to the probe. Further communications may not be possible. Save your energy. Save yourselves. Avoid the planet Earth at all costs. Farewell.
The image of his face quivers, then dissolves into static. Uhura takes a stunned breath. Kirk spins slowly around in his chair to face the crew. His eyes meet Spock's. Spock stares gravely in return. McCoy's face is shocked still. Kirk hunches over slightly and rubs his forehead.
Can you let us hear the probe's transmission?
Yes, sir. On speakers.
Spock, what do you make of that?
Most unusual. An unknown form of energy of great power and intelligence. Evidently unaware that its transmissions are destructive. I find it illogical that its intentions should be hostile.
Really? You think this is its way of saying hi there to the people of the Earth?
There are other forms of intelligence on Earth, Doctor. Only human arrogance would assume the message must be meant for man.
You're suggesting the transmission is meant for a life form other than man?
At least a possibility, Admiral. The President did say it was directed at Earth's oceans.
Brow knit pensively, Kirk takes measured steps toward Uhura. Several scanning monitors glow on the walls of the bridge.
Uhura, can you modify the probe signals accounting for density and temperature and salinity factors?
I can try, sir.
She adjusts her listening device, then presses buttons on a control panel. A nearby monitor displays rapid topographical cross-sections of an ocean. Kirk, lost in thought, stands beside Spock. Uhura taps a series of bright red diamond-shaped buttons.
I think I have it, sir.
And this is what it would sound like underwater.
Sir.
Fascinating. If my suspicion is correct, there can be no response to this message. Excuse me.
Where are you going?
To test my theory.
Bones, you stay here.
No way. Somebody's got to keep an eye on him.
Later, all three men peer up at a screen which flashes computer-generated images of fish and crustaceans. At the top, the words Phylum Search Mode. At the bottom, each animal's scientific name. The computer's search ends with the image of a whale.
Spock?
As suspected, the probe's transmissions are the songs sung by whales.
Whales?
Specifically, humpback whales.
That's crazy. Who would send a probe hundreds of light years to talk to a whale?
It's possible. Whales have been on Earth far earlier than man.
10 million years earlier, and humpbacks were heavily hunted by man. They've been extinct since the 21st century. It is possible that an alien intelligence sent the probe to determine why they lost contact.
My God.
Spock, could the humpback's answer to this call be simulated?
The sounds, but not the language. We would be responding in gibberish.
Does the species exist on any other planet?
Negative. Humpbacks were indigenous to Earth. Earth of the past.
Well, we have no choice. We must destroy the probe before it destroys Earth.
To attempt to do so would be futile, Admiral. The probe could render us neutral easily.
Oh, we can't just turn away. There must be an alternative.
There is one possibility, but of course I cannot guarantee success. We could attempt to find some humpback whales.
You just said there aren't any, except on Earth of the past.
Yes, Doctor. That is exactly what I said.
Well, in that case... Now, wait just a damn
Spock,
minute.
Spock, start your computations for time warp. Bones, you come with me.
Kirk strides toward the bridge. McCoy follows. The probe glides steadily over the Earth. Swirling bluish clouds cover large portions of the atmosphere. At Federation headquarters, Starfleet technicians scurry about.
We need that power to keep the medical and emergency facilities functioning.
All underground storage systems have been shut down due to contamination from the probe's wave.
Distress messages flash on the walls. The President and Admiral Cartwright lean intently over the console table. Two men rush in, carrying a 7-foot-long brace with an enormous clear suction cup at each end. They press one end to a window, the other to the floor. Another technician seals the window with a blowtorch. Now, in a storage bay on the Klingon ship.
Scotty, how long is this bay?
About 60 feet, Admiral.
Can you enclose it to hold water?
I suppose I could. You're planning to take a swim?
Off to the deep end, Mr. Scott.
We gotta find some humpbacks.
Humpbacked people?
Whales, Mr. Scott. Whales. About 45 to 50 feet long. About 40 tons each.
You're really gonna try time travel in this rust bucket?
We've done it before.
Sure, slingshot around the sun. Pick up enough speed, you're in time warp. If you don't, you're fried.
Don't you prefer to do nothing?
I prefer a dose of common sense. We're proposing that we go backwards in time, find humpback whales, then bring them forward in time, drop them off, and hope to hell they tell this probe what to go do with itself.
That's the general idea.
Well, that's crazy.
You got a better idea? Now's the time.
They join the crew on the bridge.
Your computations, Mr.
In progress, Admiral.
Uhura, get me through to Starfleet Command.
Now, winds whip across San Francisco Bay. Tumultuous dark clouds envelop the Golden Gate Bridge. At the Federation, static appears on a console monitor.
Red alert.
I'm picking up a faint transmission.
Red alert.
I think it's Admiral Kirk calling.
On screen.
A distorted image of Kirk's face. His magnified image appears on the wall.
We have interception at last. The call of the probe.
Satellite reserve tower. Now.
That only the extinct species, humpback whale, can give a proper response to the probe. Do you concur with this opinion?
Stabilize. Emergency reserve.
Starfleet Command, do you hear?
An officer wipes raindrops from the console.
If you meet me, we're going to attempt time travel. We are computing our trajectory.
Get him back! Get him back!
One of the windows blows in. The wind throws the brace-holding technicians onto their backs. The President, Cartwright, and Sarek squint helplessly into the rain. Now, the bird of prey shoots toward the sun.
Ready to engage computer, Admiral.
What's our target in time?
Late 20th century.
Can you be more specific?
Not with this equipment. I've had to program some of the variables from memory.
What are some of the variables?
Availability of fuel components, mass of the vessel through a time continuum, and probable location of humpback whales, in this case, the Pacific Basin.
And you programmed all that from memory?
I have.
Angels and ministers of grace defend us.
Hamlet, Act 1, Scene 4.
No doubt about your memory, Spock.
Engage computers. Prepare for warp speed.
Shields, Mr. Chekhov.
Shields, aye.
May fortune favor the foolish. Warp speed, Mr. Sulu.
The ship blasts forward, blazing a wide golden trail of light.
Warp 2. Warp 3.
Steady as she goes.
The bridge quakes.
Warp 4.
A metal plate tumbles from Spock's console. Kirk turns nervously.
Warp 5. Warp 6. Warp 7.
The ship hurtles toward the sun.
Warp 8.
There. Heat shields at maximum.
Warp 9. 9.2. 9.3.
We need breakaway speed.
9.5. 9.6. 9.7.
A monitor shatters over Uhura. Steam shoots out of a crack in a wall. The ship angles to the right and circles the sun, trailing a glowing cape of light. As it disappears, we focus on the sun's molten yellow surface, bubbling with heat and gas. The ship shoots back toward us at triple speed. Inside, a pale white glow fills the bridge. Kirk stares blankly ahead. Now, a dreamlike sequence. Rising from a layer of mist, the faces of the crew appear as stone busts, which change and melt into each other.
Spock, you're talking about the end of everybody.
An abstract, whale-like form floats toward us. It has smooth, gently rippled skin, two long, wing-like fins, and a round body. Smoke blows toward us. A stiff statue of a man floats into it and disappears. In a blue haze, gaseous white fire erupts. The plaster man floats rapidly from the fire toward us. Now, under dark water, a glimpse of a whale's belly, then thousands of bubbles. A calm pond surface appears with reeds and cattails. The grasses and water glow orange, then dissolve into a view of Kirk, eyes closed on the bridge. His face twitches. The bridge's emergency red light fades to shadow, then normal lighting resumes.
Mr. Sulu.
Kirk's eyes open. He sits up with an effort.
Mr. Sulu. Mr. Sulu.
Sulu's eyes flutter open. He casts a disoriented gaze around the bridge and slowly sits up to his console.
Aye, sir. What is our condition?
Sir, the braking thrusters have fired.
Picture, please.
The front monitor shows an orbiting view of the Earth. Kirk's jaw drops.
Earth. But when? Spock.
Judging by the pollution content of the atmosphere, I believe we have arrived at the latter half of the 20th century.
Well done, Spock.
Admiral, if I may, we are probably already visible to the tracking devices of the time.
Quite right, Mr. Spock. Engage cloaking device, Mr. Chekhov.
The Klingon ship shimmers, then vanishes against a background of starry black space.
We are crossing the Terminator into night.
Homing in on the west coast of North America.
Admiral, I am receiving whale song.
Put them on speakers.
Admiral, this is strange. The song is directly ahead. It's coming from San Francisco.
From the city? That doesn't make sense.
Admiral. We have a serious problem. Would you please come down?
In the engine room, a cluster of crystals fades, then glows again.
It's these Klingon crystals, Admiral. The time travel drained them.
Now they're giving out, decrystallizing.
Give me a round figure, Mr. Scott.
Oh, 24 hours, give or take, staying cloaked. After that, Admiral, we're visible and dead in the water. In any case, we won't have enough to break out of Earth's gravity, to say nothing about getting home.
I can't believe we've come this far, only to be stopped by this. Is there no way of recrystallizing the dilithium?
Sorry, sir. We can't even do that in the 23rd century.
Kirk and Spock leave the portly mustache Scotty. Two fitted irregular doors open for them, then close as they walk down a passageway.
Admiral, there may be a 20th century possibility.
Explain.
If memory serves, there was a dubious flirtation with nuclear fission reactors, resulting in toxic side effects. By the beginning of the fusion era, these reactors had been replaced. But at this time, we may be able to find some.
But you said they were toxic.
We could construct a device to collect their high-energy photons safely. These photons could then be injected into the dilithium chamber, causing crystalline restructure. Theoretically.
Where would we find these reactors, theoretically?
Nuclear power was widely used in naval vessels.
Spock raises his eyebrows at Kirk. Nighttime. The bird of prey soars toward a brightly lit city.
San Francisco. I was born there.
It doesn't look all that different.
Set us down in Golden Gate Park.
Aye, sir. Descending.
We'll divide into teams. Commanders Uhura and Chekhov are assigned the uranium problem.
Yes, sir.
Dr. McCoy, you, Mr. Scott, and Commander Sulu will convert us a whale tank.
Oh, joy.
While Captain Spock and I attempt to trace these whale songs to their source.
I'll have bearing and distance for you, sir.
I want you all to be very careful. This is Terra Incognita. Many of their customs will doubtless take us by surprise.
McCoy turns a wry gaze to the robed, pointy-eared Spock. He lifts an eyebrow in return.
It's a foregone conclusion. None of these people have ever seen an extraterrestrial before.
Spock frowns pensively, then rips off a strip of his thick white robe. He glances up at Kirk, then ties it around his head. It covers his sharply angled eyebrows and pointed ears. He looks at Kirk, then McCoy. Smiling, McCoy shakes his head, rolls his eyes, and glances over at the captain. Kirk stifles a giggle.
This is an extremely primitive and paranoid culture. Chekhov will issue a phaser and a communicator to each team. We'll maintain radio silence except in emergencies. Those of you in uniform, remove your rank insignia. Any questions? All right. Let's do our job and get out of here. Our own world is waiting for us to save it, if we can. Commence landing procedure.
Aye, sir.
Sulu peers out at the dark horizon, pinpointed with light. Now, two garbage men dump parked barrels into a truck.
Don't tell me you two are fighting again.
I thought you made up last night. Why are you two always fighting?
I like the way she fights. Oh. Anyway, I said to her, if you think I'm going to spend $60 for a damn toaster oven, you're out of your mind.
What'd she say to that?
They cling to the side of their garbage truck as a violent gale blasts dust and papers toward them. A couple of full trash cans topple over. Trash rolls rapidly across the park's green lawn like tumbleweeds. The men shield their eyes. A portion of the field sinks evenly, about 4 inches deep, with a trash can crushed flat in its center.
What the hell was that?
Above the sunken grass, a piercing light appears as the bird of prey's ramp lowers. The two men tiptoe toward the front of their truck. Crew members materialize some 15 feet up in the air.
Did you see that?
No, and neither did you, so shut up.
I didn't see nothing.
One man hurries behind the wheel. The other stands on a side plank and clings to the driver's side window. They drive away.
Bearing to the whales?
283 degrees, 15.2 kilometers.
Everybody remember where we parked.
All seven crew members stride down the ramp. It rises to close behind them. They march across the field into the darkness. Morning. A busy street corner in downtown San Francisco. Kirk leads the crew across the street.
Hey, watch where you're going, you dumbass!
Double dumbass on you!
Kirk throws an arm up angrily at the cab driver. Gaping indignantly, he and the others cross the street, oblivious to oncoming traffic. Kirk turns to face the passing cab and flings up both his arms. Nearby, a woman buys a newspaper whose headline reads, "Nuclear arms talk stalled."
It's a miracle these people ever got out of the 20th century.
They're still using money. We gotta find something. Spock, the rest of you stay here.
He and Spock step away. The other crew members stare after them.
And the rest of you break up. You look like a cadet review.
Scotty and Sulu chuckle. Chekov, McCoy, and Uhura mill around aimlessly on the corner, unsure of where to go. Kirk watches, then gives them a hopeless, dismissive wave before heading down the street. Now, in an antique shop, Kirk and Spock wait at a counter. A gray-haired man approaches them, holding a pair of gold-rimmed spectacles.
Yes, 18th-century American. Quite valuable. Are you sure you want to part with them?
How much would you give me for them?
Excuse me. Weren't those a birthday present from Dr. McCoy?
And they will be again. That's the beauty of it. How much?
Well, they'd be worth more if the lenses were intact. I'll give you $100.
Is that a lot?
He shrugs. Later, Kirk doles out the money.
All right, that's all there is. So don't splurge. All set? Good hunting.
The crew splits up.
Well, Spock, here we are. Thanks to your restored memories, a little bit of good luck, we're walking the streets of San Francisco, looking for a couple of humpback whales. How do you propose to solve this minor problem?
Simple logic will suffice. I believe I shall begin by making use of this map. I have the distance and bearing which were provided by Commander Uhura.
A bus catches Kirk's eye. Its billboard reads, "Have a whale of a good time. Cetacean Institute, Sausalito."
I think we'll find what we're looking for at the Cetacean Institute in Sausalito. A pair of humpback whales named George and Gracie.
How do you know this?
Simple logic.
Kirk brushes past him to board the bus. Spock follows. The doors close, then reopen. Kirk disembarks with a slightly hurt expression.
What does it mean, exact change?
Kirk shrugs, then leads Spock away. Now, McCoy, Scotty, and Sulu.
You mind telling me how we plan to convert this tank?
Ordinarily, I could do it with a piece of transparent aluminum.
I'm afraid you're a number of years too early for that.
No. We got to find the 20th century equivalent.
But where?
They watch a woman open a yellow warehouse door. The warehouse wall reads, "Can't find it? Try Pacific Bell Yellow Pages." Now, Chekov and Uhura read a phone book.
Did you find it?
Yes, under U.S. government. Now we need directions.
They rush to a police officer.
Excuse me, sir. Can you direct me to the naval base in Alameda? It's where they keep the nuclear vessels. Nuclear vessels.
Wearing black sunglasses, the brawny mustache policeman just stares at them.
Excuse us.
We are looking for nuclear vessels. Can you tell me where the naval base is in Alameda? We are looking for the nuclear vessels in Alameda. Could you tell me where?
Can you help us?
Please, we're looking for the naval base in Alameda. Could you tell me where the nuclear vessels are?
I don't know if I know the answer to that. I think it's across the bay. In Alameda.
That's what I said. Alameda. I know that.
But where is Alameda?
On a bus, a sneering punk rocker with a bright orange mohawk hairdo holds a boombox. Across from him, Kirk waves.
Excuse me. Mind stopping that noise?
The punk looks at Kirk, turns up the volume, and smirks. Kirk and Spock exchange a glance. Glaring, he gives Kirk the finger. Spock reaches over and grips the punk's neck in a Vulcan nerve pinch. Eyes rolling, the punk collapses on his box. Kirk joins the other passengers' applause.
Admiral, may I ask you a question?
Spock, don't call me Admiral. You used to call me Jim. Don't you remember Jim? What's your question?
Your use of language has altered since our arrival.
is currently laced with, shall I say, more colorful metaphors. Double dumbass on you, and so forth.
You mean the profanity?
Yes.
That's simply the way they talk here. Nobody pays any attention to you unless you swear every other word. You'll find it in all the literature of the period.
For example?
Well, the collected works of Jacqueline Suzanne. The novels are Harold Robbins.
Ah. The Giants.
Now, cars and buses stream down a steep hill. A bus stops outside of the Cetacean Institute. Kirk and Spock get off. They stride toward a glass entryway. Spock still wears his Vulcan robe and headband. Inside, behind a counter, a petite blonde woman looks up with brightening eyes.
Oh, here I go.
Smiling, she faces a group of people.
Good morning. I'm your guide this morning. My name is Dr. Jillian Taylor, but you can call me Jillian. I'm assistant director of the Maritime Cetacean Institute. So please follow me and just give a yell if you can't hear me, okay?
Kirk and Spock join the group.
The Cetacean Institute is the only museum in the world exclusively devoted to whales. As you can see, we have a great deal to offer, but that is small compared to what we know, or rather what we don't know, about whales. The first commonly held misconception is that whales are fish. They're not. They're mammals, just like you and me, warm-blooded, needing air to breathe, and producing milk to nurse their young.
Do whales attack people, like in Moby Dick?
No. No, most whales don't even have teeth. They have a soft, gum-like tissue that strains vast amounts of tiny shrimp for food, and that is the limit of their hostility. Unfortunately, their principal enemy is far, far more aggressive.
You mean man?
To put it mildly. Since the dawn of time, men have harvested whales for a variety of purposes, most of which can be achieved synthetically at this point. 100 years ago, using hand-thrown harpoons, man did plenty of damage. But that is nothing compared to what he has achieved in this century. This is mankind's legacy. Whales hunted to the brink of extinction.
Video footage of whales being carved up.
The largest creature ever to inhabit the Earth. Despite all attempts at banning whaling, there are still countries and pirates currently engaged in the slaughter of these inoffensive creatures. Where the humpback whale once numbered in the hundreds of thousands, today there are less than 10,000 specimens alive. And those that are taken in are no longer fully grown. In addition, many of the female whales are killed, while still bearing unborn calves.
To hunt a species to extinction is not logical.
Whoever said the human race was logical? Now, if you'll follow me, please, I'll introduce you to the Institute's pride and joy.
Jillian leads the group outside to a saltwater pool some 50 yards wide. A glimpse of a humpback whale. Its knobby back raises the surface as it rises, then dives.
This is the largest seawater tank in the world, and it contains the only two humpback whales in captivity.
One whale arches up beside the tank's railing.
They are mature humpbacks, weighing 45,000 pounds each. They wandered into San Francisco Bay as calves and were brought here. We call them George and Gracie.
It's a perfect spot. Male and female humpback in a contained space. We beam them up together, consider ourselves lucky.
Miss jets up from a whale's blowhole, lightly spraying the group.
Beautiful, aren't they? And extremely intelligent. Now, if you'll follow me, please.
Kirk gapes delightedly at the whales. The tour heads inside.
Despite all that they are teaching us, we have to return George and Gracie to the open sea.
Why is that?
Well, for one thing, we simply don't have enough money to keep feeding them 2 tons of shrimp per day.
How soon?
Soon. It's too bad, too, because they're really quite friendly, as you could see. I've grown quite attached to them.
Spock is no longer with the tour group.
And now, here's a much better way to see George and Gracie. Underwater.
Jillian leads them to a bank of tall windows. The group peers at the black 50-foot-long whales. One nearly noses the glass, exposing its whitish underbelly.
What you're hearing is recorded whale song. It is sung by the male.
Kirk nervously searches
He'll
the crowd.
He'll sing anywhere from 6 to as long as 30 minutes and then start again. In the ocean, the other whales will pick up the song and pass it on.
Kirk's eyes bulge as he stares at the tank. He sees Spock dive toward one of the whales, wearing only his headband, a tunic-like shirt, and underwear. He braces himself against the whale's body beside its eye. Holding on gently, he swims alongside it as if listening closely. Kirk's jaw drops as he watches.
Beyond our comprehension. Frankly, we just don't know yet.
Maybe he's singing to that man.
Jillian turns her gaze to the tank.
Let him get in there.
What the hell? Excuse me, wait right here.
Spock swims to the surface. Jillian storms down the hall. Kirk follows.
Excuse me. Excuse me, please.
She bolts upstairs. Outside, she rushes toward the tank.
All right, who the hell are you? What were you doing in there?
Yeah, speak up, though.
Attempting the hell to communicate.
Communicate? Communicate what? You have no right to be here.
You heard the lady.
Admiral, if we were to assume that these whales are ours to do with as we please, we would be as guilty as those who caused their extinction.
Okay. I don't know what this is all about, but I want you guys out of here right now, or I call the cops.
I assure you that won't be necessary. We're only trying to help.
The hell you were, Buster. Your friend was messing up my tanks and messing up my whales.
They like you very much, but they are not the hell your whales.
I suppose they've told you that, huh?
The hell they did.
Right.
Kirk squints at him. Jillian crosses her arms. Later, on a walkway.
Spock.
Yes?
About those colorful metaphors that we've discussed. I don't think you should try using them anymore.
Why not?
Well, for one thing, you haven't quite got the knack of it.
I see.
And another thing, it's not always necessary to tell the truth.
I cannot tell a lie.
I don't mean lie. But you could exaggerate.
Exaggerate?
Exaggerate. You've done it before, can't you remember?
The hell, I can't.
Spock frowns.
What else did you learn from your mind meld?
They're unhappy about the way their species has been treated by man.
Well, they have a right to be. Are they going to help us?
I believe I was successful in communicating our intentions.
I see.
Now, Jillian gazes wistfully at a whale. It blows mist as it passes her.
It's all right. Yes, I know. It's okay. They didn't mean any harm.
A brown-haired, 30-ish man wearing a plastic name tag joins her at the tank's railing. She looks down.
Heard there was some excitement.
Oh. Just a couple of kooks.
How you doing?
I'm fine.
Don't tell me fish stories, kiddo. I've known you too long.
Bob is tearing me apart, okay?
I know. I feel the same thing, but we're stuck between a rock and a hard place. We can't keep them here without risking their lives. We can't let them go without taking the same chance.
I know.
And besides, we're not talking about human beings here. It's never been proven their intelligence is in any way...
Oh, come on, Bob! I don't know about you, but my compassion for someone is not limited to my estimate of their intelligence.
As Jillian stalks away, Bob bows his head in resignation. Now, Uhura and Chekov pick their way across a rocky beach and gaze at an aircraft carrier anchored a half mile offshore. Chekov talks into his palm-sized communicator.
Team leader, this is Team 2. Come in, please.
I have the coordinates of the reactor.
Team 2, Kirk here.
Admiral, we have found the nuclear vessel.
Well done, Team 2.
And Admiral, it is the Enterprise.
Kirk holds back a sentimental smile.
Understood. What's your plan?
No.
We will beam in tonight, collect the photons, and beam out. No one will ever know we were there.
Understood and approved. Right keep me informed.
Kirk out.
Chekov grins excitedly. Now, Kirk pauses as Jillian drives past in a weathered blue pickup truck.
There she is, from the Institute. If we play our cards right, we may be able to find out when those whales are leaving.
How will playing cards help?
Well, if it isn't Robin Hood and Friar Tuck. Where you fellas heading?
Back to San Francisco.
Came all the way down here just to jump in and swim with the kiddies, huh?
Very little point in my trying to explain.
Well, yeah, I'll buy that. What about him?
Him? He's harmless. Back in the 60s, he was part of the free speech movement at Berkeley. I think he did a little too much LDS.
LDS. Come on, why don't you let me give you a lift? I have a notorious weakness for hard luck cases. That's why I work with Whale.
We don't want to be in any trouble.
You've already been that. Come on.
Kirk shoots a warning look at Spock and walks around to the passenger side door. Spock, wearing his white headband and ankle-length robe, climbs in next to Jillian. Kirk, in his rust-colored Starfleet uniform, follows him.
Well, thank you very much.
Don't mention it. And don't try anything either. I got a tire iron right where I can get at it.
Spock turns to Kirk with an expressionless glance.
So, you were at Berkeley?
I was not. Memory problems, too.
What about you? Where are you from?
Iowa.
Oh, landlubber. Come on, what the hell were you guys really trying to do back there? It wasn't some kind of macho thing, was it? Because if that's all, I'll be real disappointed. I really hate that macho stuff.
Can I ask you a question?
Go ahead.
What's going to happen when you release the whales?
Her eyes shift uneasily.
They're going to have to take their chances.
What does that mean exactly, take their chances?
It means that they will be at risk from whale hunters the same as the rest of the humpbacks. What did you mean when you said all that stuff back at the Institute about extinction?
I meant that...
He meant what you said on the tour. That if things keep going the way they are, the humpbacks will disappear forever.
No, that's not what he said, farm boy. Admiral, if we were to assume those whales are ours to do with as we pleased, we would be as guilty as those who caused, past tense, their extinction. I have a photographic memory. I see words.
Are you sure it isn't time for a colorful metaphor?
You're not one of those guys from the military, are you, trying to teach whales to retrieve torpedoes or some dipshit stuff like that?
No, ma'am, no dipshit.
Well, good. That's one thing I would have let you off right here.
Gracie is pregnant.
All right, who are you? And don't jerk me around anymore. I want to know how you know that.
We can't tell you that.
But
if you let me finish, I can tell you that we're not in the military, and we intend no harm towards the whales.
Then what do you...
In fact, we may be able to help you in ways that, frankly, you couldn't possibly imagine.
Or believe, I'll bet.
Very likely. You're not exactly catching us at our best.
That much is certain.
Jillian gives him a challenging glare. Kirk smiles sweetly.
I have a hunch that we'd all be a lot happier discussing this over dinner. What do you say?
Jillian frowns dubiously. Spock remains expressionless.
You guys like Italian?
No.
Yes. I love Italian. And so do you.
Yes.
Jillian turns away with a skeptical, sidelong glance. Now, in a factory, our view glides over the word Plexicorp on a clear window. A stocky, balding man approaches Scotty and McCoy.
Professor Scott! I'm Dr. Nichols, plant manager.
Ah!
I'm terribly sorry. There's been an awful mix-up. Would you believe I was never told about your visit?
I've tried to clear things up, Professor Scott. I explained that you'd come all the way here from Edinburgh on appointment to study methods of manufacturing by Plexicorp. But they don't seem to know anything about it.
Don't know anything about it? I find it hard to believe that I've come millions of miles...
Thousands
of miles on an invited tour of inspection.
Professor Scott, if you just...
I demand to see the owners. I demand...
Professor Scott, just take it easy. Dr. Nichols has offered to take us around the plant personally.
He has?
Yes. With pleasure.
Well, that's different.
We have to go teach him to break.
Gregory!
Dr. Nichols waves over a forklift.
Whoa! Professor!
May my assistant join us?
Of course.
They step onto the platform.
Don't bury yourself in the park.
Now Sulu approaches a helicopter pilot.
Hi. Hi. Good looking ship. Huey 204, isn't it?
Right on. You fly?
Oh, here and there. I flew something similar back in my academy days.
All right. And this must be old stuff to you.
Old? Yes, but interesting. Do you mind if I ask you a few questions?
Do it.
At Plexicorp, Nichols ushers Scotty and McCoy into a modest wood-paneled office.
Well, this is a fine place you have here, Dr. Nichols.
Thank you. And I must say, Professor, your knowledge of engineering is most impressive.
Yes, back home we call him the miracle worker.
Indeed. May I offer you something, gentlemen?
Dr. Nichols, I might be able to offer something to you.
Yes?
I notice you're still working with polymers.
Still? What else would I be working with?
What else indeed? I'll put it another way. How thick would a piece of your plexiglass need to be at 60 feet by 10 feet to withstand the pressure of 18,000 cubic feet of water?
Oh, that's easy. 6 inches. We carry stuff that big in stock.
I have noticed. Now suppose, just suppose, I were to show you a way to manufacture a wall that would do the same job, but be only 1 inch thick. Would that be worth something to you, eh?
You're joking.
Perhaps a professor could use your computer.
Please.
Scotty sits at a Macintosh.
Computer?
He cocks his head at the monitor.
Computer?
Flustered, McCoy hands him a mouse.
Ah.
He holds it to his mouth.
Hello, computer.
Just use the keyboard.
The keyboard. How quaint.
He cracks his knuckles. As he types, chemical configurations and formulas flash in rapid succession across the screen. Nichols' mouth drops open. With a satisfied grin, Scotty stands up. Nichols eases into the chair, his eyes glued to the molecular diagram on screen.
Transparent aluminum?
That's the ticket, laddie.
It'd take years just to figure out the dynamics of this matrix.
Yes, but you would be rich beyond the dreams of avarice.
So, is that worth something to you? Or should I just punch up clear?
No.
A red-headed woman enters.
Not now, Madeline!
She freezes, then tiptoes back out. Nichols gazes hungrily at the formula.
What exactly did you have in mind?
Well, a moment alone, please.
McCoy leads Scotty to the other side of the office while Nichols fixates on the computer screen.
You realize, of course, that we give him the formula. We're altering the future.
Why? How do we know he didn't invent the thing?
McCoy's eyes shift in thought. He breaks into a grin.
Yeah.
Now, Jillian's blue pickup stops at the edge of Golden Gate Park. Spock squeezes past Kirk and climbs out.
Sure you won't change your mind?
Is there something wrong with the one I have?
Little joke. Bye, old friend.
Wait a minute. How did you know Gracie's pregnant? Nobody knows that.
Gracie does. I'll be right here.
He starts across the field.
What? He's just gonna hang around the bushes while we eat?
Kirk shrugs.
It's his way.
Her mouth agape, Jillian turns the truck around and stares at Spock as she passes. As they drive away, Spock dematerializes in a 7-foot transporter beam of orange light and disappears. Later, in an Italian restaurant.
Do you trust me?
Implicitly.
Large mushroom pepperoni with extra onions and a Michelob, please.
Great choice. And you, sir?
Like that, too.
Thank you.
Kirk gives Jillian a flirtatious smile.
I'll be right back with your drinks.
Well. How does a nice girl like you get to be a cetacean biologist?
Just lucky, I guess.
You're upset about losing the whales, aren't you?
Her smile fades.
You're very perceptive.
How will that be done exactly?
They'll be flown in a special 747 to Alaska and released there.
Flown, and that's the last you'll see of them?
See, yes. But we'll tag them with radio transmitters on a special frequency so that we can keep tabs on them.
Kirk rubs his hands together anxiously.
You know, I could take those whales somewhere where they'd never be hunted.
Her green eyes wide and hopeful, Jillian gazes at him, then breaks into a skeptical grin.
You can't even get yourself from Sausalito to San Francisco without a lift.
If you have such a low opinion of my abilities, how come we're here having dinner?
Sucker for hard luck cases. Cheers.
Kirk takes a sip of beer. His nose wrinkles in slight puzzled distaste.
Besides, I want to know why you travel around with that ditzy guy who knows that Gracie's pregnant and calls you Admiral.
Kirk avoids her searching gaze.
Where could you take them?
Hmm?
My whales. Where could you take them where they'd be safe?
Well, it's not so much a matter of a place as of a time.
Well, the time would have to be right now.
Why right now?
Let's just say that no humpback born in captivity has ever survived. The problem is that they won't be that much safer at sea because of all the hunting this time of year. So you see, that as they say is that. Damn.
She gulps her beer.
What is that?
What's wrong?
You have a pocket pager.
He stares helplessly.
Are you a doctor?
He pulls out his communicator and tries to cover it with his hands.
What is it? I thought I told you never to call me.
Sorry, Admiral. We just thought you'd like to know. We're beaming them in now.
All right. Tell them phasers on stun. Good luck, Kirk out.
He flashes an embarrassed smile.
You want to try it from the top?
Why don't you tell me when those whales are leaving?
Who are you?
Who do you think I am?
Don't tell me. You're from outer space.
No, I'm from Iowa. I only work in outer space.
Oh, well, I was close. I mean, I knew outer space was going to come into this sooner or later.
The truth?
Oh, I am all ears.
Okay. The truth.
He takes a quick sip of beer. Jillian waits with an indulgent grin.
I am from what on your calendar would be the late 23rd century. I've come back in time.
Her mouth drops open.
To bring two humpback whales with me in an attempt to repopulate the species.
She nods in mock seriousness.
Well, why didn't you just say so? I mean, why all the coy disguises?
You want the details?
Oh, I wouldn't miss this for all the tea in China.
When are those whales being released?
Okay. What the hell? Your friend was right. Gracie's not only pregnant, she is very pregnant. And at noon tomorrow, in what is sure to be a media circus, the whales get shipped out.
Noon tomorrow?
He jumps to his feet as the pizza arrives.
Are we leaving?
Come on. We don't have much time.
Could we have that to go, please?
Sure. Who gets the bad news?
Don't tell me they don't use money in the 23rd century.
Well, we don't.
She grabs the check. Now dust settles over the aircraft carrier. A sign reads USS Enterprise. On board, a sailor walks a search dog, a black and tan German Shepherd, through a narrow passageway. The dog stops at the top of a staircase. The officer leads him away. On the floor below, Uhura and Chekhov crawl out from behind the stairs. Uhura reads the signal on her tricorder and follows it to a metal control panel with a red and yellow radioactive caution sign. She sweeps the tricorder over the panel and points excitedly. Chekhov crouches and sets a hand-sized gray metal photon collector against the wall.
How long?
Depends on how much shielding there is between us and the reactor.
They nervously scan the empty corridor. Now, headlights glowing through the misty darkness, Jillian's truck returns to the deserted park.
Well, Admiral, that was the briefest dinner I've ever had in my life. And certainly the biggest cockamamie fish story I've ever heard.
You asked. You tell me something. George and Gracie's transmitter. What's the radio frequency?
Sorry, that's classified. Look, I don't have a clue who you are, really. But you wouldn't want to show me around your spaceship, would you?
That wouldn't be my first choice, no.
Well, there we are.
Let me tell you something. I'm here to bring two humpbacks into the 23rd century. If I have to, I'll go to the open sea to get them. I'd much rather have yours. It's better for me. Better for you. It's better for them. Think about it.
He climbs out and shoots a penetrating stare through the open window.
Who are you?
Think about it, but don't take too long. I'm out of time. You change your mind, this is where I'll be.
Here? In the park.
Jillian looks away, her lips pressed together in a skeptical frown. She backs the truck into reverse and heads toward the entrance of the park. Holding the pizza box, Kirk watches her go, then hurries toward the invisible Klingon ship. A flashing orange light plays across Jillian's shoulder. Brow furrowed, she stops the truck and peers back at the field. Kirk has disappeared. With a curious frown, she ducks her head back into the truck and drives away. Now, in the ship.
Status?
The tank will be finished by morning.
It's cutting it closer than you know. What about Team 2?
No word since beaming. We can only wait for them to call.
Damn. Damn it! I've been so lucky. The two perfect whales right in our hands. If we don't move quickly, we'll lose them.
In that event, the probabilities are that our mission would fail.
Our mission? Spock, you're talking about the end of every life on Earth.
You're half-human. Haven't you got any goddamn feelings about that?
His razor-straight eyebrows lowered in a slight frown, Spock slows to a stop as Kirk storms away, then bows his head thoughtfully. On the aircraft carrier, Chekov and Uhura scan the halls while red lights flash on the photon collector. Their eyes dart to the metal-grated ceiling directly above, where a marine patrols the upper hull. Now two sailors at a radar station.
There it is again. That's too weird. Commander?
I thought you gents were running a test program.
Yes, sir, but we apparently are getting a power drain. I mean, it must be coming from inside the ship.
CIC Command Duty Officer Commander Rogerson. Yes, Chief, we're tracking that too. What do you make of it?
Now, Chekov shuts off the collector and nods to Uhura, who pulls out her communicator.
Scotty, we're ready for beam out. Scotty, can you hear me?
Confirmed. Roger that.
With a sober frown, the command duty officer picks up another phone.
Mardet commanding officer, this is the command duty officer, Commander Rogerson. We have an intruder in number 4 MMR. I say again, we have an intruder in number 4 MMR.
Scotty, do you read?
On the ship, Scotty frowns at the static.
Yes, I can hardly hear you. My transporter power is down to minimal. I got to bring in one at a time.
Take the collector. You go first.
Uhura hesitates, then nods. She takes the collector and stands up, straightening her rust-red tunic.
Stand by.
Uhura fades, grows transparent, and disappears in the orange transporter beam.
Scotty. Hello.
Chekov looks upward and climbs to his feet.
Come in, please.
He paces to the middle of the room.
Scotty, how soon? Chekov, you're breaking up. Please signal again. Chekov, can you hear me? Scotty, now would be a good time.
Marines surround him.
Freeze! Chekov!
Scotty shoots a panicked frown at Uhura.
I've lost him.
Commander Pavel Chekov, Starfleet, United Federation of Planets.
A slick-haired FBI agent.
All right, Commander.
Is there anything you want to tell us?
Like what?
Like who you really are and what you're doing here and what these things here are.
I am Pavel Chekov, a commander in Starfleet, United Federation of Planets. Service number 656-5827D.
All right. Let's take it from the top.
The top of what?
Name.
My name?
No, my name.
I do not know your name.
You play games with me, mister, and you're through.
I am? May I go now?
The agent stares in disbelief, then leans toward a colleague.
What do you think?
He's a Ruski.
That is the stupidest thing I've ever heard in my life. Of course he's a Ruski, but he's a retard or something.
We better call Washington.
Chekov grabs a phaser.
Don't move.
Okay, make nice. Give us the ray gun.
I warn you. If you don't lie on the floor, I will have to stun you.
Go ahead. Stun me.
I'm very sorry, but...
The agent smirks.
Must be the radiation.
He grins sheepishly, then throws the phaser at the startled agent and bolts out the door. Chekov sprints down a narrow hallway, his brown leather suit standing out in sharp contrast to the sailors' blue uniforms. Marines in fatigues dash up the metal stairways, cradling rifles. Chekov skids around a corner and dashes onto the hangar deck, weaving through groups of sailors. The Marines' leather boots pound after him. The sailors drop to the ground as the Marines pour onto the hangar deck. Chekov gallops toward a gangplank, doubling back as sailors cut him off at the entrance. Surrounded on both sides, he leaps over a pile of boxes and topples at the edge of a railing. He lands on a cement deck 20 feet below. Two sailors rush to his side.
Man down! Get a Corwin over here!
Hey, Marie, what's going on?
Now Kirk strides onto the bridge of the Klingon ship.
Any luck?
Nothing. Admiral, I should never have left him.
You did what was necessary. Keep trying to find him.
He pushes a button on the captain's chair.
Scotty, you promised me an estimate on the dilithium crystals.
It's going slowly, sir. It'll be well into tomorrow.
That's not good enough, Mr. Scott. You've got to do better.
I'll try, sir, Scott. Well, he's in a wee bit of a snit, isn't he?
He's a man of deep feelings.
Aye. What else is new?
Morning. Jillian's weathered blue pickup truck rolls to a stop in front of the deserted Cetacean Institute, scattering a handful of gray pigeons that peck at the ground. Wearing jeans and a sweater, she hops out and strides to the entrance. She peers in with a worried frown, unlocks the door, then freezes. Outside, the whale tank stands empty and dry. A lone custodian mops the deserted poolside. She hurries outside, gapes in disbelief, then barges back in.
They left last night. We didn't want a mob scene with the press. It wouldn't have been good for them. Besides, we thought it would be easier on you this way.
You sent them away without even letting me say goodbye, Jillian, to them? You son of a bitch!
Bob's eyes widen in shock. Jillian storms toward the front door. Outside, a worker hoses the sidewalk. She hits her truck and flings herself inside. Gasping with sobs, she leans her head on the steering wheel. She raises her head suddenly, teeth clenched in determination. Now, soaring over San Francisco Bay, Sulu flies a helicopter with a huge box of plexiglass sheets dangling from its landing skids. He reaches for a switch. The windshield wiper starts. Sulu's eyes fly open in surprise as he fumbles with the controls. Now, with the rectangle of plexiglass swinging by ropes, the chopper hovers over Golden Gate Park. Jillian's truck barrels onto the field, sending clouds of dust flying into the air. It skids to a stop on the grass. Jillian jumps out. Desperately scanning the empty field, she glances up and freezes. 50 feet above, Scotty's head pokes out from midair as Sulu lowers the plexiglass into the invisible ship. Jillian's mouth drops open.
Admiral! Admiral Khan!
She runs toward the wide, 4-inch-deep indentation in the grass. She bangs into an invisible wall and lands on her rump, then reaches out and feels the ship.
Admiral!
Scotty sees her from above. Inside, supervising the installation of a plexiglass wall, Kirk sees Jillian on a monitor.
Admiral! Admiral! Can you hear me?
He hurries to the rusty transporter panel and presses several buttons.
I need your help! Oh my God!
She disappears in the transporter beam and materializes on board. She stands gasping. Kirk steps toward her.
Hello, Alice. Welcome to Wonderland.
Oh, it's true.
It's true.
What you said.
Yes, it is. I'm glad you're here, but I must admit you picked a hell of a time to drop in. Oh, take it easy.
Her knees
buckle.
We need
your help. No, you
don't. Is any of this real?
Yes, it's real. Take a look.
Outside, Sulu lowers the plexiglass walls into the ship, sealing off the cargo bay.
Storage tanks for your whales. We'll bring them up the same way we brought you up.
They're gone.
Gone?
They were taken last night. I wasn't told. They're in Alaska by now.
Damn.
But they're tagged, like I told you. I mean, you can go find them, right?
Can't go anywhere.
What kind of a spaceship is this?
It's a spaceship with a missing man.
Admiral, full power has been restored.
Thank you, Mr. Spock.
Hello, Doctor. Welcome aboard.
She nods hesitantly.
Admiral, are you there?
He turns on an intercom.
Yes, Uhura. What's wrong?
I've located Chekov, sir. They're taking him to emergency surgery right now.
Where?
Mercy Hospital.
Mercy Hospital?
Oh, that's in the Mission District.
They report his condition as critical.
He's not expected to survive.
McCoy climbs up from a lower deck.
Jim. I've got to let me go in there. Don't leave him in the hands of 20th Century Medicine.
Admiral. May I suggest that Dr. McCoy is correct? We must help Chekov.
Kirk studies Spock's impassive face.
Is that the logical thing to do, Spock?
No, but it is the human thing to do.
Kirk grins.
Right. Will you help us?
How?
Well, we're going to have to look like physicians.
Later, they stride through a hospital corridor wearing green surgical scrub suits.
We'll try down here. You check there.
Kirk and Jillian keep walking. McCoy wanders down a separate hallway where a white-haired woman lies on a gurney.
Oh.
What's the matter with you?
Kidney dialysis.
Dialysis? My God, what is this, the Dark Ages? Here.
He hands her a pill.
You swallow that. And if you have any problems, just call me.
Now, Kirk and Jillian flip through charts hung on a wall.
Here, I got it.
He takes them off.
Let's go.
They meet up with McCoy, who stands in front of a floor diagram.
He's being held in the security corridor, one flight up. His condition is critical. Come on. Excuse me. We'll take that.
They take a gurney from an orderly. Jillian jumps on. Kirk covers her with a sheet as they race for an elevator.
Hold the door. Hold that door. Emergency. So, there what happened?
Yeah, I was there. I heard the whole thing.
Two young doctors.
Weintraub says radical chemotherapy or she's gonna croak just like that.
Well, what about Gottlieb?
What do you expect? All he talked about was image therapy. I thought they were gonna punch each other out.
Unbelievable.
You have a different view, doctor?
Sounds like a goddamn Spanish Inquisition to me. Bad day.
They wheel Jillian out of the elevator and toward an operating room with policemen posted outside.
Out of the way. Sorry, doctor. Strict orders, not
to work.
Damn it, do you want an acute case on your hands? This woman has immediate postprandial upper abdominal distension. Out of the way. Get out of the way.
Confused, the police let them through.
What did you say she's got?
Cramps.
McCoy bends over Chekov with a tricorder.
Who are you? Why aren't you masked? Who are these people?
I don't know.
What the hell is that? What are you doing?
tearing of the middle meningeal artery.
What's your degree in? Dentistry?
How do you explain slow in pulse, low respiratory rate, and coma?
Fundoscopic examination.
Fundoscopic examination is unrevealing in these cases.
A simple evacuation of the expanding epidural hematoma will relieve the pressure.
My God, man. Drilling holes in his head's not the answer. The artery must be repaired. Now put away your butcher knives and let me save this patient before it's too late.
I'm gonna have you removed.
Doctors, doctor, such unprofessional behavior. Into that little room, please.
What is that? You, a gun?
Kirk waves his phaser and herds the surgical team into a supply room.
No idea.
He aims it at the door lock and fires a thin orange beam.
He melted the lock.
Dealing with medievalism here. Chemotherapy. Fundoscopic examinations.
The doctors peer through the glass as McCoy sets a different visor-shaped tricorder on Chekhov's forehead.
Come on, Chekhov, wake up.
They hover over Chekhov, gazing at his still face.
Oh, can you hear me?
His eyelids flutter.
He's coming around, Jeff.
McCoy removes the tricorder.
Pavel, talk to me. Name, rank.
Chekhov. Pavel. Rank. Admiral.
Later, they wheel him out on the gurney.
How's the patient, doctor?
He's gonna make it.
He came in with a sheet.
One little mistake.
The policemen rush into the operating room.
Get us out of here!
They fumble helplessly with the supply room door.
They've taken the patient. Get some help!
The police dash out. Kirk, McCoy, and Jillian start to run through the crowded hall, pushing Chekhov's gurney. The policemen skid around a corner.
Hold it!
Chekhov lifts his head with a groggy frown. Kirk squashes his face back onto the gurney. The police pound after them.
Hold it!
Jillian peers desperately over her shoulder. Surrounded by doctors, the white-haired woman wheels past them, smiling and waving excitedly.
Fully functional.
They barrel through a double door and crash into a man on crutches, sending him flying. McCoy pauses to check him, then helps Kirk and Jillian get Chekhov into an elevator. The door closes as the policemen barge into the corridor. Seeing the closed elevator door, they sprint down an emergency stairway to the floor below and draw their guns just as the elevator opens. The team materializes in the park.
Where would the whales be by now?
See, if you have a chart on board, I'll show you.
No. All I need is the radio frequency to track them.
What are you talking about? I'm coming with you.
You can't. Our next stop is the 23rd century.
Well, I don't care. I've got nobody here. I have got
to
help
those
whales!
I haven't got time to argue with you. I want to tell you how much you meant to us. The radio frequency, please.
Frequency is 401 megahertz.
Thank you. For everything. Scotty, beam me up.
She jumps into his arms.
Surprise!
Together, their bodies dissolve in a portal of golden light, then disappear. On board.
Spock, where the hell's the power you promised me?
One damn minute, Admiral.
I'm ready, Spock. Let's go find George and Gracie.
Sulu? I'm trying to remember how this thing worked. Got used to a Huey.
You tricked me.
You need me.
Ready, sir.
Take a seat. Now, Mr. Sulu.
Two joggers get caught in a sudden blast of wind and swirling dust. Blown sideways, they stagger toward a wooden fence and hold on.
What the hell was that?
Now, our view tilts sharply to the right as we fly over San Francisco. Jillian's mouth drops open.
Cloaking device is stable. All systems normal.
Stabilize energy reserve. Report, Helm.
Maintaining impulse climb. Wing 5x0. Helm steady.
Advise reaching 10,000. Steer 310.
310, aye.
Uhura, scan for the whales. 401 megahertz.
Scanning, sir.
10,000 MSL, Admiral.
Wing, cruise configuration. Full impulse power.
Aye, sir. 310 to the Bering Sea. ETA, 12 minutes.
Scotty, are the whale tanks secure?
Aye, sir. But I've never beamed up 400 tons before.
400 tons?
Well, it's not just the whales. It's the water.
Yes, of course.
He steps over to Uhura's station.
The whales, any contact?
Negative, sir.
Now, our view zooms toward the sun as we skim over puffy white clouds. McCoy sits with Spock.
You present the appearance of a man with a problem.
Your perception is correct, Doctor. In order to return us to the exact moment we left the 23rd century, I have used our journey back through time as a referent, calculating the coefficient of elapsed time in relation to the acceleration curve.
Naturally. So what's your problem?
Acceleration is no longer a constant.
Well, then you're just gonna have to take your best shot.
Best shot?
Guess, Spock. Your best guess.
Guessing is not in my nature, Doctor.
Nobody's perfect.
McCoy gives Spock a lingering, satisfied smirk. Spock studies him impassively, then raises his pointy eyebrows as McCoy turns away. Now, Jillian sits next to Uhura, who fiddles with the glowing red buttons on her communications board.
That's it! Affirmative. Contact with the whales.
Bearing.
Bearing 327, range 600 nautical.
Put it on screen.
How can you do that?
On screen.
Now, in the distance, we see George and Gracie breaking through the hazy, iron-gray surface of the ocean. Jillian's expression grows soft.
Admiral, I have a signal closing in on the whales, bearing 328 degrees.
Let's see it.
The faint outline of a ship moves through the water.
What kind of ship is that?
It's a whaling ship, Doctor. Are we too late?
A bearded whaler steers toward the surfacing whales.
Full power descent, Mr. Sulu.
Aye, sir. Full power descent.
The crew leans back as the ship plunges into a steep dive. Below the ocean surface, we see George and Gracie swimming side by side with slow, graceful flaps of their tails. From the whaling ship, we see the giant animals surface for air. The white-haired captain watches them through binoculars. Two crew members ready a razor-sharp, 4-foot-long metal harpoon mounted in a heavy cannon. As the rusty, battered ship plows through the waves, George and Gracie dive back under and sail through the rich blue depths. On board the Klingon Bird of Prey, Kirk fixes a steely gaze on the display screen. Jillian closes her eyes, her chest heaving with shallow, anxious breaths. The two whales bob gently in the clear blue water, filtered sunlight playing across their black, tapered bodies. Two of the whale hunters crouch beside the cannon, scanning the water ahead. Sulu studies his instrument panel.
10 seconds, sir.
Kirk stares intently at the screen. Jillian gulps nervously. We fly toward the whaling ship and skim over its masts, then continue to plummet toward the ocean. Underwater, we see the whales glide up with leisurely slowness from the depths, spouting cloudy vapors as they surface for air. The hunters fire the harpoon. It hits an invisible wall and falls limply into the water. The Klingon ship uncloaks directly overhead, casting a huge shadow, and hovers over the boat like a bird studying an insect. Panicking, the captain and navigator scramble to slam the boat into reverse as the crew members bolt from their posts.
All right, Scotty, it's up to you.
10 seconds, Admiral.
George and Gracie float underwater.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
His mouth open in concentration, Scotty presses the transporter buttons. Glowing shards of orange light spread across the whale's bulky bodies, then shimmer behind the plexiglass walls of the storage tank. Scotty's eyes bulge with excitement as the light fades and disappears, leaving George and Gracie floating in the tank.
Admiral, there'll be whales here!
They watch him through the glass.
Well done, Mr. Scott. How soon can we be ready for warp speed?
Full power now, sir!
If you will, Mr. Sulu.
Aye, sir. Warp speed.
The ship emerges from the clouds and shoots away in a streak of light.
Mr. Sulu, you have the car. I'm going to take our guest down and have a look at her whales. Well, Mr. Spock, have you accounted for the variable mass of whales in water in your time reentry program?
Mr. Scott cannot give me exact figures, Admiral, so I will make a guess.
A guess? You, Spock? That's extraordinary.
With an excited, boyish grin, Kirk leads Jillian from the bridge. Spock shakes his head and frowns.
I don't think he understands.
No, Spock. He means that he feels safer about your guesses than most other people's facts.
Then you're saying it is a compliment?
It is.
Ah. Then I will try to make the best guess I can.
In the cargo bay, Kirk and Jillian stand gazing into the whale tank, transfixed by George and Gracie's massive presence.
They say the sea is cold, but the sea contains the hottest blood of all.
Jillian turns to him in surprise.
Whales weep not. D.H. Lawrence.
You know, it's ironic. When man was killing these creatures, he was destroying his own future.
The beasties seem happy to see you, Doctor. I hope you like our little aquarium.
A miracle, Mr. Scott.
A miracle? That's yet to come.
He walks away, eyebrows raised.
What does that mean?
It means that our chances of getting home are not too good. You might have lived a longer life if you'd stayed where you belong.
I belong here. I am a whale biologist. I suppose by some miracle you do get them through. Who in the 23rd century knows anything about humpback whales?
Got a point.
The ship starts to shake.
What was that?
Admiral, I think you better get up there. We're having a power fall off.
Stay with me. On my way.
Kirk hurries out. Jillian walks over to Scotty.
Hold on tight, lassie. Gets bumpy from here.
The ship zooms away from Earth.
7.5! 7.9!
Shields at maximum.
Kirk staggers to the captain's chair.
Mr. Sulu, that's all I can give you!
Can we make breakaway speed?
Hardly, Admiral. I cannot even guarantee we'll escape the sun's gravity. I shall attempt to compensate by altering our trajectory.
Warp 8. 8.1.
Maximum speed, sir. Admiral, I need thruster control.
Acceleration thrusters at Spock's command.
Steady.
The ship hurtles around the flaming white-hot sun and disappears on the far side of its bubbling surface. On board, the crew members sit absolutely still. Kirk's mouth drops open as he glances around the bridge. He turns to Spock.
Did braking thrusters fire?
They did, Admiral.
Kirk leans forward anxiously.
Then where the hell are we?
The lights dim, then go completely black.
A probe.
Emergency lights flicker on.
Condition report, Spock.
No data, Admiral. Computers are non-functional.
The mains are down, sir. Box power is not responding.
The ship hurtles out of the cloud-filled sky.
Switch to manual control, Mr. Sulu.
I have no control, sir. My God, Jim, where are we?
Out of control and blind as a bat.
Get him back! Get him back!
At Federation headquarters, Sarek points out the broken window.
Look!
The ship plummets toward the ground.
They're heading for the bridge!
Its rear engine flickering, the ship disappears in a bank of black, swirling clouds. Tossing waves and walls of tumbling mist engulf the Golden Gate Bridge. The ship emerges from the clouds and slips just beneath it.
Ground good. Keep the nose up if you can.
The Bird of Prey skids across the turbulent surface of the ocean. On the bridge, sparks fly, pipes burst, and steam erupts from equipment. The ship, its back end submerged, lurches to a stop, jolting everyone forward.
We're in the water! Blow the hatch!
Spock pops open a round metal door. Mist pours in.
This is the right place, Spock. All we have to do is get the whales out of here before we sink! Abandon ship! Scotty, do you hear me? Scotty! Yes. Move! See the safety of all hands.
I will.
Sulu climbs out of the hatch into the driving rain and crawls down the outside of the sinking ship. Spock and Chekov help Uhura through while Kirk pries at the heavy metal doors of the bridge with his hands. As they slide open, he darts into the narrow, smoke-filled passageway. Now the gleaming, cylindrical black probe hovers in space. Kirk dashes through piles of wreckage toward the cargo bay, where the whales float amid a tangle of loose live wires. Scotty and Jillian wade through chest-high water.
Lassie, get my arm!
They bang on the closed metal door.
Scotty! I'm let out of... Help! I'm here, Scotty! I'm here!
Kirk grabs a crack in the door and strains to pry it open. Scotty and Jillian pull on the other side. As it slides open, Kirk takes Jillian's hand and hauls her out.
You're gonna be all right.
Whales are trapped. They'll drown.
There's no power to the bay door. Explosive override. That's underwater. There's no way to reach it. You all ahead. And close the hatch.
Admiral, you'll be trapped.
Go on.
Kirk strips off his soaking wet jacket and wades deeper into the cargo bay. Jillian takes Scotty by the hand and leads him through the debris-filled corridor. Kirk takes a deep breath and dives underwater. Trailing a web of air bubbles in the dark, murky water, he maneuvers his way through chunks of wreckage and swims toward a round override panel next to the whale tank. He punches a series of buttons. The panel springs open, revealing a handle in a lit compartment. Kirk takes the handle in both hands and tries to yank it down. Air bubbles spurt from his mouth with each pull. The bay doors blow open in a fiery explosion, sending milky white air bubbles spiraling upward. On the surface, Jillian and Scotty join the rest of the crew as they stand on a small ledge, clinging to the side of the nearly submerged Bird of Prey. Underwater, Kirk swims through the open bay doors toward the surface. Spock reaches out and grabs his hand.
Do you see them?
Chekov shakes his head. Jillian helps Spock pull Kirk to the ledge, then points excitedly. A massive black tail fluke rises out of the water. It slaps the surface and disappears as the whale holds one fin out of the water, gazing at them with its tiny dark eyes. Kirk points.
Fire!
The second whale dives down to join its mate in the calm blue depths.
Why don't they answer? Why don't they sing?
At Federation headquarters, Starfleet personnel gaze helplessly at static-filled screens. Now, suspended in water, one whale maneuvers into a headstand position. The second whale follows, floating nose down. The probe hovers motionless in space. With sunlight glinting off its corrugated, scoured, yet smooth black surface, the probe rotates slowly into a similar headstand position. Cast in shadowy silhouette, the outline of the probe faintly echoes the long, sleek profile of the whales. Squinting against the pelting rain, the Enterprise crew listens. The segmented, translucent blue globe, suspended by its thin column of light, twirls slowly overhead. One whale spins slowly, turning its small, wrinkle-lidded eye toward us. Now, the probe retracts the globe back into its body, extinguishing the pillar of light, and turns away with immense slowness. In the sunlight, the probe's black surface resembles a whale's back. It glides away from us and heads into a flickering canopy of stars, suspended in the blackness of space. The whales straighten up as the probe flies away. They break through the surface as the rain-drenched crew cheers them on with smiles and waves. Now, in a high-speed reversal, dense black rain clouds give way to puffy white ones, which swirl and shrink in the bright sunlight. The probe sails past the space dock, which comes to life with blue light. Then the probe flies up and away. At Federation headquarters, the screens go clear of static.
President, we have power.
Now, beneath a sun-filled blue sky, the crew watches the whales with giddy smiles. As the whales breach the water in leap after joyous leap, Kirk responds with a robust slap on the watery surface. He takes Jillian's hand and pulls her into the water. One by one, the crew members dive off the ledge and splash each other playfully. A giant fin rises out of the water and slaps the surface in an exuberant wave. Spock struggles as Kirk drags him off the ledge. Together, they plop into the water. The whales' backs arch above the surface as they swim toward the Golden Gate Bridge and the open sea. A boxy white shuttlecraft zooms overhead. Later, in the vast Federation Council chamber, Council members talk amongst themselves.
Council is now in session. You all take your seats.
The President stands at a podium.
Bring in the accused.
Kirk strides in, followed by McCoy, Scotty, Uhura, Chekov, and Sulu. Spock rises from his seat beside Sarek and Jillian to stand with Kirk.
Captain Spock, you do not stand accused.
Mr. President, I stand with my shipmates.
As you wish. The charges and specifications are conspiracy, assault on Federation officers, theft of Federation property, namely the Starship Enterprise, sabotage of the USS Excelsior, willful destruction of Federation property, specifically the aforementioned USS Enterprise, and finally, disobeying direct orders of the Starfleet Commander. Admiral Kirk, how do you plead?
On behalf of all of us, Mr. President, I'm authorized to plead guilty.
So entered. Because of certain mitigating circumstances, all charges but one are summarily dismissed. The remaining charge, disobeying orders of a superior officer, is directed solely at Admiral Kirk. I'm sure the Admiral will recognize the necessity of keeping discipline in any chain of command.
I do, sir.
James T. Kirk, it is the judgment of this council that you be reduced in rank to captain, and that as a consequence of your new rank, you be given the duties for which you have repeatedly demonstrated unswerving ability. The command of a starship.
Kirk's eyes light up. Jillian beams.
Silence, Captain Kirk. You and your crew have saved this planet from its own short-sightedness, and we are forever in your debt.
The council members, both human and alien, jump to their feet. Blinking back happy tears, Jillian grins widely and claps. We glimpse a council member with a blue face and antennae, another with a cat-like head, and humanoids in various uniforms. The crew members turn to acknowledge the applause and are quickly surrounded by well-wishers. Jillian moves through the crowd shaking hands. Kirk scans the milling throng looking for her. She rushes up to greet him.
I'm so happy for you, I can't tell you. Thank you so much.
She starts to walk away.
Wait a minute, where are you going?
You're going to your ship, I'm going to mine. Science vessel. I got 300 years of catch-up learning to do.
You mean this is goodbye?
Why does it have to be goodbye?
Well, like they say in your century, I don't even have your telephone number. How will I find you?
Don't worry. I'll find you.
She gazes at him with a tender smile, then kisses his cheek.
See you around the galaxy.
His mouth hanging open in a confused smile, Kirk watches Jillian walk away. He snaps out of his trance when he sees Spock approach Sarek, whose hands are clasped in a meditative pose.
Father, I'm returning to Vulcan within the hour. I would like to take my leave of you.
It was most kind of you to make this effort.
It was no effort. You are my son. Besides, I'm most impressed with your performance in this crisis.
Most kind.
As I recall, I opposed your enlistment in Starfleet. It is possible that judgment was incorrect. Your associates are people of good character.
They are my friends.
Yes, of course. Do you have a message for your mother?
Yes. Tell her I feel fine.
Sarek raises his eyebrows.
Live long and prosper, Father.
Live long and prosper, my son.
They exchange a Vulcan greeting, their hands raised and palms facing out, with their fingers split into a V. Sarek watches Spock walk away, then turns and leaves the hall, his long robes flowing behind him. Kirk joins Spock. They stride away together. Now, shuttlecraft fly in and out of the mushroom-shaped space dock. The crew of the Enterprise flies past.
The bureaucratic mentality is the only constant in the universe. We'll get a freighter.
With all respect, Doctor, I'm counting on Excelsior.
Excelsior? Why in God's name would you want that bucket of bolts?
A ship is a ship.
Whatever you say, sir, they will be done.
With a skeptical frown beneath his bushy mustache, Scotty peers over Kirk's shoulder. As the shuttlecraft flies over the sleek Excelsior, the crew's mouths drop open. Just behind the giant starship lies a new USS Enterprise, number NCC-1701A.
My friends,
We've come home.
Light plays over the new ship's front saucer, cylindrical hull, and bar-shaped engines. Later, the crew takes their stations.
Helm ready, Captain.
All right, Mr. Sulu.
Kirk grins excitedly.
Let's see what she's got.
The Enterprise streaks away at warp speed. This film has been described for blind and visually impaired audiences by Descriptive Video Service, a service of the WGBH Educational Foundation. Funding provided by the United States Department of Education. Described by Nancy Baker and Leslie Wu Fawley. Descriptions read by Madge Kaplan. Now, over scenes from the movie, credits roll. Cast: William Shatner as Kirk, Leonard Nimoy as Spock, DeForest Kelly as McCoy, James Doohan as Scotty, George Takei as Sulu, Walter Koenig as Chekhov, Nichelle Nichols as Uhura, Jane Wyatt as Amanda, Catherine Hicks as Jillian, Mark Leonard as Sarek, Robin Curtis as Lieutenant Savick, Robert Ellenstein as the Federation Council President, John Shuck as the Klingon Ambassador, Starfleet personnel, Brock Peters as Admiral Cartwright, Michael Snyder as the Starfleet Communications Officer, Michael Berryman as the Starfleet Display Officer, Mike Brislane as the Saratoga Science Officer, Grace Lee Whitney as Commander Rand, Jane Wiedlin as the Alien Communications Officer, Vijay Amritraj as the Starship Captain, Majo Barrett as Commander Chapel, Nick Ramos as the Saratoga Helmsman, Thaddeus Golis as Controller Number 1, Martin Pistone as Controller Number 2. In Old San Francisco, Scott Devenny as Bob Briggs, Viola Stimson as the Lady in Tour, Phil Rubenstein as the First Garbage Man, John Miranda as the Second Garbage Man, Joe Noland as the Antique Store Owner, Bob Sarlatti as the Waiter, Everett Lee as the Cafe Owner, Richard Harder as Joe, Alex Henteloff as Nichols, Tony Edwards as the Pilot, Eve Smith as the Elderly Patient, Tom Mustin as Intern Number 1, Greg Karras as Intern Number 2, Raymond Singer as the Young Doctor, David Ellenstein as Doctor Number 1, Judy Levitt as Doctor Number 2, Teresa E. Victor as the Usher, James Menges as the Jogger, Kirk Thatcher as the Punk on Bus, Naval Personnel, Jeff Lester as the FBI Agent, Joe Lando as the Shore Patrolman, Newell Tarrant as the Command Duty Officer, Mike Timoney and Jeffrey Martin as the Electronic Technicians, First Sergeant Joseph Naradze, USMC, as the Marine Sergeant, First Lieutenant Donald W. Zautke, USMC, as the Marine Lieutenant. Stunts: Stunt Coordinator R.A. Rondell, Stunt Double for William Shatner, John Meyer, Stunt Double for Leonard Nimoy, Gregory Barnett, Stunts by Steve M. Davison, Clifford T. Fleming, Eddie Heiss, Benny E. Moore Jr., Charles Piserny Jr., Sharon Schaefer, and Spike Silver. Unit Production Manager Mel Efros. First Assistant Directors Patrick Keough and Douglas E. Wise. Second Assistant Director Frank Capra III. Visual Effects Supervisor Ken Ralston. Associate Producers Brooke Breton and Kirk Thatcher. Casting by Amanda Mackey. Casting Administrator Bill Shepard. Camera Operator Keith Peterman. First Assistant Photographer Kenneth Nishino. Second Assistant Photographer Jay Peterman. Sound Mixer Gene S. Cantamessa, CAS. Boom Operator Stephen G. Cantamessa. Utility Mark Jennings. Special Effects Supervisor Michael Lanteri. Special Effects Clay Pinney, Brian Tipton, Don Elliott, Robert Spurlock, and Tim Moran. Costumes designed by Robert Fletcher. Men's Wardrobe Supervisors James Lynn and Eric Harrison. Men's Wardrobe Joseph Markham and Dan Bronson. Women's Wardrobe Mary Etta Lang. Makeup Artists Wes Dawn, Jeff Dawn, and James L. McCoy. Hairstylist Sylvia Abascal. Additional Hairstylists Carol O'Connell and Monique Dessart. Script Supervisor Lily LaCava. Chief Lighting Technician Cal Manning. Assistant Chief Lighting Technicians Lloyd Gowdy and Frank McCain. First Company Grip Calvin Sterry. Second Company Grips Waverly Smothers and Mike Brooker. Dolly Grip Richard Dow. Set Decorator John Dwyer. Property Master Ron Greenwood. Assistant Property Master Kay Trapp. Lead Person Bart Sussman. Property Persons Charles Certain, Huey Duval, and Bill Dolan. Construction Coordinator Dick Bayard.
Construction foreperson John H. Matheson. Paint foreperson Ed Charnock. Standby painter Jerry Gaudet. Art directors Joe Obel and Pete Smith. Assistant art directors Joe Hubbard and Nilo Rodas. Set designers Dan Gluck, James Bayless, and Richard Berger. Location managers Michael Mann and Michael Meehan. Transportation coordinator Stu Statterfield. Transportation captain Ray McLaughlin. Craft services Tom Jones. Unit publicist Andrew Lipschultz. Still photography Bruce Bermelin. Assistant film editors George Villasenor and Thomas Bryant. Negative cutting by Real People Incorporated. Color timer Bob Raring. Title design by Dan Curry and Harry Moreau. Sound effects by Mark Mangini. Sound effects editors David Stone, MPSE, Michael J. Benevente, Warren Hamilton, MPSE, and Stephen Flick, MPSE. Special sound effects John Pospisil, Alan Howarth, and George Budd. Foley editors Solange Schwab and Tim Mangini. Foley by Dan O'Connell and Ellen Hoyer. ADR editor Nick Korda. Assistant editors Destiny Borden and Christopher Flick. Sound effects recordist Doug Hemphill. Supervising music editor Elsa Blongsted, music editor David Marshall. Additional musical score by Leonard Rosenman and the Yellow Jackets. Orchestrations Ralph Ferraro. Music scoring mixer Dan Wallen. Scoring Record Plant Scoring. Re-recording mixers Terry Porter, Dave Hudson, and Mel Metcalf. Underwater director of photography Jack Cooperman, ASC. Production coordinator Gina Nielsen. Production auditor Robert Cecil Thorson. Assistant production auditor John R. Craig. DGA trainee Joe Adamson. Voice casting Barbara Harris. Assistant to Mr. Nimoy, Ori Cerrone. Assistants to Mr. Bennett, Sylvia Rubinstein, and Bridget Rue Lauf. Assistant to Mr. Winter, Rebecca R. Brookshire. Assistant to Mr. Roddenberry, Susan Sackett. Production assistants, Susan Smith and Kevin F. Barry. Visual effects produced at Industrial Light and Magic, Marin County, California. Effects director of photography, Don Dow. Visual effects art director, Nilo Rodas. Optical supervisor, Ralph Gordon. Whale design and project supervisor, Walt Conti. Visual effects editor, Mike Gleason. Matte painting supervisor, Chris Evans. Model shop supervisor, Jeff Mann. Animation supervisor, Ellen Lichtwort. General manager, ILM, Warren Franklin. Visual effects coordinator Eric Jensen, production manager ILM Ed Hirsch, storyboard artist John Bell, camera operators Selwyn Eddy III, John V. Font, Peter Dalton, Toby Heindel, and Pat Sweeney, assistant camera persons Ray Gilberti, Joe Carson, Pete Kozachik, and Marty Rosenberg, optical camera operators Don Clark, Dave McHugh, and Jim Hagedorn. Optical lineup Peg Hunter and Bruce Fakito. Optical coordinator Lori J. Nelson. Lab technicians Tim Geideman and Todd Heindel. Whale mold supervisor Sean Casey. Whale mechanical designer Rick Anderson. Whale operators puppeteers Tony Hudson and Mark Miller. Underwater whale photography Pete Romano. Assistant effects editor Terry Peck. Matte photography supervisor Craig Barron. Matte artists Frank Ordaz, Caroline Green, and Sean Joyce. Matte photography Randy Johnson. Chief model maker Larry Tan. Model makers Eric Christensen and Paul Krause. Animation camera operators Bruce Walters and Jay Riddle. Rotoscope artist Ellen Ferguson. Visual consultant Ralph McQuarrie. Pyrotechnician Bob Finley Jr. Stage technicians Brad Jarrell, Dick Dova, and Mike Olegu. Production assistant Ned Gorman. Time travel ILM Computer Graphics. Creatures created by Richard Snell Designs and Dale Brady, Craig Caton, and Alan Feuerstein, Shannon Shea, Brian Wade, and Nancy Nimoy. Computer animation and tactical displays, video images, John Wash and Richard Hollander, and Novacom Incorporated, Jim Gerken, Mark Peterson, and Michael Okuda. Video supervisor, Hal Landeker. Chief engineer, Alan Landeker. Process coordinator, Donald Hansard, Sr. Copyright 1986 by Paramount Pictures Corporation. All rights reserved. Star Trek is the trademark of Paramount. Paramount Pictures Corporation and is registered in the United States Patent and Trademark Office. Theme from Star Trek television series, music by Alexander Courage. Genesis Project by Craig Huxley. I Hate You, written by Kirk Thatcher. Arranged by Mark Mangini and performed by Edge of Etiquette. Original soundtrack album available on MCA Records and Tapes. The producers extend special thanks to Monterey Bay Aquarium, Monterey, California, Humpback Whale Sounds, courtesy of Roger Payne and New York Zoological Society, Mark Ferrari and Debbie Glockner-Ferrari of the Humpback Whale Fund, Howard Weinstein, Nabisco, Apple Computer Company, and Roy Danchik. The producers also gratefully acknowledge the cooperation of the Department of the Navy and the Department of Defense and the following individuals: Rear Admiral Charles Reynolds McGrail, Captain Walter Davis, Lieutenant Sandra Stairs, Lieutenant Lee Saunders, Mr. John Horton, and the officers and men of USS Ranger, Marine Detachment, USS Ranger, U.S. Coast Guard Long Beach, and the U.S. Coast Guard San Francisco. Additional optical effects by Westheimer Company. Sound by Todd A.O., Glen Studios. Color by Technicolor, filmed in Panavision. Dolby Stereo, co-produced by Industrial Light and Magic. A disclaimer. The persons and events in this motion picture are fictitious. Any similarity to actual persons or events is unintentional. This motion picture is protected under laws of the United States and other countries. Unauthorized duplication, distribution, or exhibition may result in civil liability and criminal prosecution. Paramount, a Gulf and Western company.